Hey there, this is your friendly co-host, Robert. What you are listening to is a rebroadcast of Forgot My Dice episode 16 titled Retroactive Spoiler Alert, also known as the episode we had recording issues. And because of that, it sounded terrible. We are really sorry about that. And we said we fixed it, and we haven't had recording issues since, and I will knock on wood for that right now. Knock, knock, knock. As always, content is a year old and covers topics and news that have long since happened, but feel free to check out the show notes on ForgotMyDice.com and join us in the Forgot My Dice fans Facebook group. Enjoy the show.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
Episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast. This is Jonathan Edwards, your host, and sitting across from me, as always, the Ernie to... No, you're definitely the Bert. The Bert to my Ernie.
So that comes up Robert?
No, because you're definitely spicier. You're a little
hateful-er.
Yeah, he's got that... I can see Bert on an internet forum giving somebody a hard time. I can totally see that.
I only rarely do that.
The Bert to my Ernie, Mr. Robert Lundgren. How you doing?
Hello, hello. I'm doing good. Oh, this weather's trying to kill me.
Yeah, you and me both.
Like, today's been okay because it's been cloudy and rainy, which means when it gets sunny again, whatever has been killing me for the last couple of days...
will bloom and make our lives miserable.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. I don't know what it is. Like, the cedar didn't get me, but whatever's going right now is just murdering me.
Before we get started with this episode 16 of the podcast, and it's hard to believe that we're at 16 already, we do have a few announcements to make. And the first is, if you've been paying attention and listening all the way to the end of the last couple episodes of the show...
Our experiment.
It is now over. So we've been running a contest.
That we have. So if you're hearing this now and it's news to you, sorry, the contest is over as of right now.
Gives you an incentive to listen to the end of the show, doesn't it?
So yes, in episode 14 and 15, we ran a little contest to get a copy of Kaiju Incorporated. As of this episode releasing, that contest is over. We will no longer accept any submissions. And we will announce a winner next time. And oh my gosh, we may not be able to roll a dice. And not because it's a weird number, but we are getting dangerously close to no more die. Oh, I do have a D30, though. I might be able to pull that guy out. But yeah, we're getting close to the D20 no longer being necessary.
Which is kind of nice. It's nice to know at least 20 people are making it to the end of the episode.
Exactly.
Speaking of contests, we do have a big announcement to make for the future of the show, which is awesome. We've gotten a lot of really good feedback. We are getting a lot of additional exposure, and we're having so much fun doing this show that we have decided to continue for the indefinite future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And to help that along, we are going to be launching a Patreon initiative.
Well, we actually already have launched the Patreon. I quietly launched it 3 days ago. I've linked to it in a little teeny tiny part of the site, but we have not announced it. I was saving the hullabaloo and all that for this episode. But yes, the Patreon is launched, actually, as of right now, and we have no patrons right now. But then again, I have not announced it at all, so I'm not terribly shocked. We want to have a little bit more money to basically have a budget to do some stuff.
Yeah.
If one of your wonderful golden microphones breaks... That comes right out of our pocket, and that kind of sucks. Or, you know, the website. The website, surprisingly, is not cheap. So anything that kind of doesn't give us a reason to not do this anymore because those bills get taken care of, that would be super. So right now, our first goal is just, like, help us pay for the site every year. Yay! And incidentals. And I don't know what we'll add if we get north of that, but we'll add something, I guess.
If we get to the point where we start to have that conversation, we will definitely bring it forward and include everybody in that conversation.
Truth.
Because really what it's going to do is come back directly to you. So for those folks that might not be in the know, the way a Patreon works is you go and you make a subscription, basically to the show, and you put a dollar amount, and monthly that dollar amount gets charged to your credit card. And it comes to us and helps us fund the show. Now, it's important to note that podcasting is a surprisingly expensive endeavor. We want to produce a show that sounds great. We want to produce a show that is slightly not amateurish.
Yeah, slightly.
And to
honestly, I'd like to like go places. Like I'd like to have FMD on the road.
Yes.
That'd be awesome.
To do that, we have a lot of equipment that we need to purchase. Soundboard, microphones, cabling, all this other fun stuff.
So what does this mean to you, gentle listener? Well, I'm glad you asked. We are going to run a new contest! Brand new. If you subscribe to our Patreon, we will take all of our Patreon subscribers between right now and when episode 20 hits. And what you will get is we will randomize all of our subscribers on Patreon, and you will get the complete set of Savage Rifts books.
And these are great-looking books, by the way. They are fantastic.
So we got the Tomorrow Legion Player's Guide, which is the player's book. We got the Game Master's Handbook and Savage Foes of North America, the complete set, direct to you, our Patreon subscribers. So, yeah, go and sign up at patreon.com. Go to the show notes. We will definitely have a link.
And if for any reason you can't join the Patreon, we totally understand. It's completely optional. We're not going to stop doing the show or doing anything like that.
No.
It just, you know, every little bit helps to kind of keep us going and keep the lights on. That being said, let's get on to more fun stuff. And that's actually something that we're mulling over for the future of the show. We are thinking about doing a full-fledged campaign review.
Mainly this is me. We played a lot of games that you can play in a campaign lately and reviewed them, and I have gotten jelly because we have not had the opportunity to actually play the campaign. And I was thinking to myself, why don't we play the campaign and see if we can make good podcasting out of that? So we're kind of like, we've got like three or four games that we're kind of looking at right now, including, you know, Arcadia Quest Inferno, Widower's Wood's coming out soon. There's a bunch of stuff that we're sort of looking at. But we just kind of want to know what you guys think. Like, if the idea is we would do two episodes where we talk about how the game's going and how the campaign's going, and then we take an episode off and do a review of something else. So we would break it up because, you know, if the campaign goes really, really long, we don't want to have like 6-7 episodes in a row where us just talking about Widower's Wood chapter 16 or whatever we're at. So that's, you know, we'll do two on, one off. And we'll do it for as long as it seems interesting or if we get burned out on the game or whatever. But yeah, playing campaign games sounds fun. And then telling you what the campaign experience is for this game and kind of updating you over time. Unfortunately, it'll probably be spoilerific. But yeah, you know, if you have any opinions on it, let us know. You know, the usual methods.
Our Facebook, our Twitter, our website, and of course the Freebooters Network where you can join our forums. Give us a little bit of feedback about what you think of that idea. And we're still kind of fleshing it out and how it'll sound and look. And as we get a little bit closer, we'll let you know that it's coming again. For now, we're going to continue with our current format.
At least for another episode.
Yeah, as we continue to explore the idea. So, that's announcement.
We had three. That's so impressive.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
It's like we're real. It's like we're a real podcast.
Almost. moving on, let's go ahead and get started with the show. And, of course, we're going to start with our off-the-shelf segment. This is our segment where we get a chance to talk about all the cool things that we've had off the shelf. And I think we should get started with the one that you and I did together, which was our painting party.
Painting party!
So we continue to prep our Blood Bowl game for a full review.
This keeps getting more and more elaborate. Next thing we're going to do, we're going to sew, like, jerseys. I don't know how we can make this more elaborate, but yeah, we've decided, well, you decided that you wanted us to paint our armies before we play, because you want full pageantry.
I do.
So
I want the full Blood Bowl experience.
Yeah, so
I'm really excited about reviewing Blood Bowl. This is a game I've been interested in for quite some time. And then when the 2016 version came out, really, that was just my impetus to really seek it out and start to learn the rules and maybe even get it together. Well, we've gotten a copy for review, and we're really excited about it. So
I made the new mistake when we were painting. I pulled out not 12, but 11 of my guys and started painting them. And now I've got just a primered white 12th guy that was sitting in the thing the whole time. And I still haven't fixed him yet. One of our rules for our painting party is we're not going to paint outside of our painting party. We're going to have another update. We'll probably post a photo to Twitter like we did the last time.
Yes, most likely we'll have our next painting party in a week, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And we'll get another two or three colors on our minis.
So, yeah, so check out our Twitter, check out our Facebook. We'll be posting pictures pretty regularly as we prep our teams.
So speaking of Games Workshop stuff, we had a Warhammer store open up right near us.
Yes, we did. And we both went and checked it out.
We both went and checked it on separate days because we couldn't align our
schedule. Yeah, it just wasn't happening that weekend.
But yeah, I went on opening. They had cake, and my daughter was so happy. She got free cake, which was weird. It was a room full of gamers. They'd been open at that point for 3 or 4 hours. The cake had obviously been sitting there that whole time. Only one slice taken.
Weird.
So, yeah, my daughter fixed that. So yeah, and my wife, she enjoyed a slice of cake. I had no idea that they had rebranded the store into Warhammer Stores. I remember actually reading that, but it didn't click with me that that's what had occurred. So I was like, Warhammer Store? I'm confused. But yeah, Games Workshop rebranded all their stores Warhammer.
It's a beautiful store.
It is a very pretty store.
Nice gaming tables.
Yeah,
really nice scenery on their tables.
Yeah, too. And I failed my wisdom save. I
I know you brought the model to the painting party.
Yeah, yeah. What's her? I can't even pronounce his name. Drycha Hamadreth. There we go.
It's okay. I failed my wisdom save too.
Well, you just bought a white dwarf. I bought a $60 model, sir.
Oh, no, no. I bought a white dwarf and a rule set.
Ooh.
I bought the General's Handbook for Age of Sigmar because... Nice. I think I'm 100% enamored with the
Caradon
Overlords.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm going to slowly construct a Caradon Overlord army.
Well, we have agreed that you'll take whatever model of yours is $60, and
yes.
I'll take my $60 model, and we will throw them at each other just to test out the rule set. So maybe that'll be a really, really sad deep dive. Like, we'll play Age of Sigmar with one model.
Well, I've decided that the way I'm going to approach this is I am a completionist at heart, and so I'm going to only allow myself to get a single model, and I'm not going to let myself get any more until I finish painting and constructing the one. So that's how I'm going to kind of, you know, slowly build up my
Jonathan,
my
let me
forces.
Ask you a question, because your willpower is low, and I'm aware of this. How much do you want me to keep you to it? If I see you buy another model, I can bring over a hammer and smash it just out of spite.
How about you just take the model away?
Okay.
Rather than, you know, smashing it. That's the cheaper option.
I'm sneaky, too. I'm a big guy. You don't think of it, but I can get it out on the sly. That happens.
Now let's go ahead and turn and towards our TV and movie habits. I haven't had a chance to watch a lot of TV. I'm really behind, but I see here that you're excited about the Legends of Tomorrow finale.
Well, yeah, Legends of Tomorrow had their finale. And, yeah, they had the What a Twist at the end, which will be amusing when it happens next season. Because, you know, may or may not involve a city with a bunch of random buildings that are out of time and space and dinosaurs. Because, you know, things happen. Spoiler alert, sorry. The series just ended pretty well. I remember watching the first series and I don't know why I kept watching it.
Yeah, either do I. It didn't make any sense to me. And then about halfway through I realized I was kind of enjoying myself.
Yeah, and then the tail end of the season got significantly better, especially like the last three or four episodes.
There was just enough charm in those first 6 to 8 episodes to keep you coming back for more. And that's when they found their groove and really genuinely started making some cool stories.
Yeah, and season two, they really embrace their nerd roots because there's an episode where they travel in time and they go interact with J.R. Tolkien. There are so many quotes to Lord of the Rings in that episode. It's amazing.
They just completely gave up on trying to legitimize it and anchor it in real life. And they just decided, let's just embrace what we are. We're a comic book show. Let's do some comic book
stuff.
And let's
just be stupid. You know what? All heck.
That was the wise decision. They are better for it.
Yes. And then I finally watched Rogue One.
My gosh. The goodness, the hotness, the amazingness.
Yes.
It's finally out on video, and I've watched it 3 times since it came out.
Yeah, I've watched it twice, yes. So, I don't know what to say about that movie. That probably hasn't already been said. I was just cursed. Every time I tried to make plans to go watch it, it's just something.
Yeah, I've had movies like that before.
But finally watched it. It's good. I liked it a lot. It threaded a really interesting needle. And
it did it well.
Yeah, and considering how much, like, trouble the production had that I heard about, you know?
I think that was all overblown. I gotta be honest with you. Having seen the finished film now several times... There's no way that there were that many issues. I think what it was is just standard reshoot stuff that got blown way out of proportion because
they changed the ending pretty significantly. Because in the preview, you can see Jin running down a beach with the hard drive in her hand in like slow motion with everybody else. And that obviously didn't happen. So I think it looks like the ending got a pretty significant change. Supposedly they all died in that ending too, but maybe they just all got like gunned down on the beach, which maybe is a little dark. Maybe them dying separate heroic deaths was probably a better way to end it.
Well, I gotta say,
spoiler alert, sorry people. It's been has it been a year? No, it hasn't been a year. It's not up yet. Retroactive spoiler alert.
I don't know. Either way, the movie is brilliantly put together. This is the prequel that actually legitimizes and makes the movie that comes after it better. All of a sudden, episode 4 has this huge impact and this toll associated with it that wasn't there before. And even just those first few minutes of episode 4 when the rebels are on the Tantive IV, you understand why they're so terrified. There's a reason why those guys are freaked out. And that's because they've just survived this huge battle. So kind of shifting gears a little bit to video games, I'll start this one out. I have been having a chance to play a few games. I've been playing a little bit more Ghost Recon Wildlands, a little bit more Battlefield 1, which got its first expansion, and the new maps are awesome. And I got access to the new Sniper Elite 4, which is really neat. That series continues to get better and better with each release. It used to be a budget game. And now it's become this full-blown, really well-produced title.
Yeah, I've heard good things.
Yeah,
playing Snipers is kind of fun, so I might check it out.
It's awesome.
I don't know what I'm going to buy. My brain has been so wrapped up in Mass Effect Andromeda for so long
now. Which I barely touched. I need to get back into that.
Well, I beat it, sir.
I'm not surprised. Because how many hours have you put into this thing already?
53.
And how many?
Which, if you listen,
completion?
That's 82%.
Oh.
Well, I'm going to wait, because there's going to be DLC, and I'll want to have other things to do besides the DLC, because that'll carry me through for a little bit. So I'm just kind of, I kind of burnt myself out, you know. As we talked about last episode, at that point I put 43 hours in the game, so I didn't have much left after last episode.
Well, at least you got it out of your system.
Yeah, I actually didn't play video games for 5 days after that.
That is unheard of.
I'm done. I'm spent. I just watched YouTube videos. I'm like, I can't even pay attention long enough to watch something more than 5 minutes. No, it's good. Like we were criticizing it last episode, and you know, again, all those criticisms we had are perfectly valid. But the storyline was fun. They had a lot of interesting ideas I really liked. I'm not going to spoil anything, but a lot of stuff came up that was interesting. It was very Mass Effect-y. It's kind of like Force Awakening it. That'd be my overall review. It's very much like the first game, and there's a lot of things that are like the first game, but then there's like kind of, but they're also different. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
There's some bits I'm going to steal for sure for future RPG campaigns and whatnot, because they had a couple interesting ideas. The ending was a little bit of a letdown, but then again, every Mass Effect ending is a little bit of a letdown. The better boss fights in the final DLC, which is like nothing new for any of their games, because, you know, most people aren't going to see that final boss fight. So what are you going to spend your time on? Are you going to spend your time on the first third of the game, which most of the players who buy the game will see? Are you going to spend your time on the last third of the game, which, you know, maybe 20%, 25% are actually going to bother with? I was surprised. Like, we were talking about the lazy writing with the characters, and I will agree, the characters were very inconsistent.
Yeah.
Because some of them I didn't care about. Some of them I loathed. I've never been a very big Krogan guy. And Drac grew on me. And by the end of the game, I was really pissed I couldn't take him more, because the way I kitted out my character, he just didn't... He wanted to be up close and personal, and I was playing Vanguard, so I wanted to be up close and personal. It wasn't really working. I need someone to kind of watch my back and shoot. Mm-hmm. So I didn't take him a lot, but I really liked his storyline, and I was like, made me want to play the game again. Overall, I'd give it a thumbs up. It's good. Every criticism you heard is valid. They released a patch that fixed a few things recently.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the reasons why I held off. I was getting a little frustrated with some of the bugs that I kept running into, so I decided to wait for a patch.
Oh, and I've been playing the multiplayer, which is actually very fun.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so it's squad-based. You just kill AI stuff.
It's kind of like the multiplayer in 3?
Yeah, yeah, very much like it. So, but you get to jump around in the jump jets, which is fun.
Yeah, the handling and of the characters.
Yeah, the combat by far is the best thing about that game. Yeah. And multiplayer is just that with other people.
Fair enough.
It's good.
Fair enough.
So there you go.
So, moving on, let's talk a little bit about gaming. Any board games or RPGs that you've had out on the table?
No.
Oh, sad 2 weeks?
Yeah, although I might be playing a role-playing game on Friday.
Hey, good times. Yeah, I can't wait to hear about it in the next episode.
I can't talk about it.
All right,
it's
then.
That game.
Nah, I gotcha. Well, I've had an opportunity to play a few games. I've played some more Mass Morrow with my kids, and they're continuing to really, really like it, as am I.
Yes.
I like it because, and we're going to talk about this in the deep dive, there are some big differences from Arcadia Quest, and the one thing that I really like about it is that it is very scenario-based and single-play-based, which makes it awesome for me to whip out with the kids. It's less to kind of track long-term. Got a chance to try a new game called Tavarua. And this is a game about surfing, which I never thought would actually become a good board game. But this is from the designer of Zaya, Legends of a Fallen Star. The game is really well designed. It's quick and it's fun. It's a little difficult to kind of understand if you are not a surfer, because it uses a lot of terminology that...
Well, just watching Point Break will fix that.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I am an FBI agent!
Not the new one, the old one.
Yeah. No, nobody wants the new one.
I watched the new one.
Apparently including anybody in the theaters.
I watched the new one. It was on Hulu.
So sorry.
It was hard to sit through.
Yeah, I don't doubt that for a heartbeat. Yeah, it's got a really neat mechanic where you have to paddle out to the waves, and then you have to catch a wave. And then you have a little tableau in front of you that shows how long your board is. And you have two types of boards. You can do short boards or long boards. And there are a total of 5 and 7 balance positions on these two boards. So when you first catch the ride, you have to do that by playing a card. And that card says, hey, your balance pitches forward or backward X number of spots. So yeah, then you need to look at this deck that's coming up that gives you a hint on the back of the deck, and that's what the wave is going to do. And so basically saying you might pitch forward or back 1 to 3 spaces. And by looking at that deck, you have to kind of decide what card, because the card that you play gets played beforehand. And so you're basically trying to move around the board and keep your balance before the wave does its action and tries to throw your balance a different direction. It's really, really neat mechanic, and it really works well. Plus, when you play the game, you get to play with little cardboard surfboards that are out on the ocean, and the ocean actually travels in towards the shore. Every turn, you take the last tile of the ocean, move it to the back of the line, and push everything else forward, like the waves are coming in at the shore.
That's cute.
Yeah, it's a really good mechanic, and you have a little meeple that you get to lie down on the board when you're paddling out and stand up when you're surfing in. So it's good times. And that's Tavarua from Far Off Games. I had a chance to sit down and play some more Dresden Files, continuing to really like that game. I think we need to put that on our review calendar because it's fun.
Hint, hint. Nudge, nudge. Say no more.
I will not. I like the core mechanics. It's a tough game, but that makes victory so much sweeter.
You had me at There's a Paladin in it. And I will play anything with Paladin.
And speaking of Paladins, I also got a couple plays in with my kids and with you of Arcadia Quest Inferno. But we're going to be saving that discussion for later because that is our deep dive game for the episode. Well, that's what we've had off the shelf. Of course, we want to know what you've had off the shelf. So please join our discussion online.
And next up, The Wisdom of Crowds, where we actually talk about Kickstarters again because there's not as much news out of Gamma. In fact, there is no news out of Gamma because Gamma was over. This thought's getting away from me. Listen, we'll be back.
We'll be back after a short word from our sponsors.
And now a quick message from our sponsors, Geek Nation Tours. And what an amazing tour they've got coming up at Gen Con 2017, which is, of course, the 50th anniversary of Gen Con. Now, along with hanging out at Gen Con, which is epic in and of itself, this tour is going to have a zombie theme. You're going to get a chance to meet Mantic Games, creators of the Walking Dead all-out war game. You're going to get an opportunity to play with Hunter Games Outbreak Undead, which is an epic game where you're actually going to have an opportunity to try and survive a real-life zombie apocalypse as you try to return to the hotel from the convention center. Along with all this, you'll also get an opportunity to play the game Zombies, the game Zombie Dice, and you'll get a chance to try out the new Steamforged Games Dark Souls board game based on the amazing video game. So to learn all about that and so much more, head on over to geeknationtours.com and take a look at what's available.
Do you have a tabletop, board game, miniature game, or RPG that you're going to release for retail?
Or do you have an upcoming tabletop Kickstarter that you're about to launch?
We would love to interview you for a future episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast.
Send us an email to fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com to schedule an interview.
And now it's time for Wisdom of Crowds, our bi-weekly news and Kickstarter segment. So, Robert, we've got some really good stuff to talk about today, and I'm going to go ahead and take the first one because it's right up my alley. One of my favorite games from 2015. And actually, you quite liked it, too.
It was sublime.
Yeah, taking it back all the way to the...
All the way to the Netherworld, the early days.
the very first of our two pilots.
Before I had two twin babies. That's crazy.
We are, of course, talking about Scythe. And Scythe, it's getting its second expansion.
Yeah. This one's got flying boats, which is the coolest kind of boats.
Yeah,
because they don't
absolutely exist. No, I mean, it's called Scythe the Wind Gambit. And this is the second expansion, of course, after Invaders from Afar, which added two more players.
It only kind of barely counts because it added players. This one actually has new rules. And this is what I like about it. Apparently, this got its start from the dude's Facebook account or the Facebook group. Somebody added an expansion using airships, and he was like, I like this. Let's develop this more, person on Facebook. This isn't just Jamie Stegmaier. This is guy on Facebook, which is to say, people, post your homebrew on Facebook. Apparently, it pays off occasionally.
Yeah. Man, how gorgeous is this art?
Yes. What's got flying boats? That's just cool no matter how you slice it.
So if you want to get a preview for the art on the cards, go ahead and go to our show notes, and we'll put a link to the product page on Stonemaier's website. Additionally, the Secret Cabal podcast is having a Kickstarter right now, and one of the promos that they're handing out for backers is, in fact, a new Scythe event card, And that card does feature one of the airships on it. So that'll be the first way to get it into your collection. That's different from what we're getting in this expansion. Because like you said, this expansion does have complete rule changes and a couple new miniatures. You actually get airship miniatures.
Yeah, for every faction, which is real cool.
Including the ones from Invaders from Afar. Well, and the best part is the MSRP. This is only $30 MSRP. You get 7 airships. You get a bunch of cards to support it and rules and resolution tiles that add basically this new twist to Scythe.
That is Scythe the Wind Gambit coming soon.
According to his page right now, he's shooting for Q4 2017. He's hoping to have it ready for Essen.
So is that Blizzard soon? I think that's Blizzard soon.
No, I think
that's... Because that's not real soon. Real soon would be this quarter.
What is it? Real soon, Blizzard soon, or Valve soon?
Valve soon, but it's definitely not
Valve soon.
It's not Valve soon.
No, you know, Stegmeier's pretty good about hitting his dates. If he puts a date attached to it, you're pretty much guaranteed that it's going to come out then.
I'll go with real soon, then, because it's a date far out, but it's probably set in stone. It's not nebulous. Well, this next one's up my alley. As we've been talking about, Paradox Interactive bought White Wolf Studios a while ago and got all their IPs, and they have now just announced what they're going to do with the role-playing side of it, and they have said, coming in Q1 2018, Vampire the Masquerade 5th Edition will be coming out. And so I think this tanks the plans, because Onyx Path was talking about making their own 5th Edition, and I think this kind of has usurped that and replaced it. And furthermore, they said they're going to continue the trend, and Werewolf will be out after that. They didn't say if it'll be 2019 or later that year, but if they follow the White Wolf tradition, they'll do a yearly release up through whatever game they decide to stop at.
Now, they're talking about a Q1 2018 release for this one.
Yeah. They say it's going to focus a little bit more on Europe because Paradox Interactive is a European company and not a US-based company. But still, you know, Blast from the Past coming back and, you know, updated rules, new stuff, you know, will they integrate the events of the end of the world that ended the last version of Vampire? Or will they just conveniently ignore that? Who knows? It probably means that the Onyx Path Vampire stuff is probably going to go the way of the dodo. They still have the license to produce the 20th anniversary things that they've been producing, but I think once that runs its course, I think they're not going to have that anymore, which is sad.
Now, there's one asterisk to this particular story that's very worrisome to me. They say that they have not made a final decision yet as to whether or not they're going to distribute the games in the U.S.
Write a letter to your senator? I'm not sure who should complain to on this one, but...
Well, I mean, I'd imagine just reaching out to White Wolf and letting him know that you want to see it in the U.S. is something that can definitely be done.
I am unconcerned. I'm sure they will. They can... Well, I probably shouldn't say that out loud. I'm sure a company could be that stupid, but they shouldn't be that stupid. I guess I will send an at White Wolf and say, bring that game over to the U.S. Grr.
Now, next up is new news from CMON, Cool Mini or Not. After the successful funding of Rising Sun, which did break the $4 million barrier, they were teasing that the Zombicide team was quite upset that Black Plague got dethroned as CMON's most funded Kickstarter game. So, the Zombicide team is back at it, and they are coming out with, I guess, what would kind of be akin to Season 2 from the original Zombicide games, and this is a direct sequel to Black Plague, so it takes place in the same medieval universe, and that is Zombicide Green Horde.
This one looks fun, too, because the Green Horde obviously is goblins and orcs, which are classics, but the art makes it look like it's, on top of that, undead goblins and orcs, which... That's a little chocolate in your peanut butter. Puts a new spin on zombies, the orc zombie and the goblin zombie. So I can't wait to see the minis for it. I'm sure they're going to be pretty.
I would say that Black Plague and the changes that they made to the Black Plague rule set are exactly what Zombicide needed to stay fresh and stay pertinent. And now the best part is, if you are a Zombicide Black Plague player, you're going to be able to bring all your heroes into Green Horde. And if you were a backer of Massive Darkness and got the Zombicide crossover kit, which lets you take all your heroes from Massive Darkness and bring them into Zombicide and vice versa, that will be fully compatible as well, which is awesome. So this game will be coming to Kickstarter at the end of May, so that's just right around the corner, so we'll have to start a watch for that, just like we did for Rising Sun.
So that's Zombicide the Green Horde, coming to you in May on Kickstarter.
Next up is something that's definitely out of your wheelhouse, Robert. Tell us all about it.
So they announced with the Unearthed Arcana that just hit, actually last week, where they did starter spells, that Unearthed Arcana is going back to a monthly release, and they're going to fire up Sage Advice again, which was their sort of FAQ column that they would do where people chime in with rules questions and they would write them down, and then typically that would also update the errata at the same time.
So for those folks not familiar with it, what is Unearthed Arcana?
Unearthed Arcana is, it started as a monthly release where they would release new sort of playtest D&D content, or just new content in general that they would hammer out, and it's been a lot of things, new class archetypes, they did like a patch so you could play Eberron, and so they released, you know, kind of a rough version of the Eberron races and whatnot. So you get things like that. You get the Psionic class came out 3 times now, actually, in Unearthed Arcana. It's probably a sign that they're releasing a rules expansion. They've been hinting at it for quite a while now. It'll be the November release from the looks of things. And it probably means that everything they need playtested and for people that's not them to look at, they've probably gotten everything out. It's probably a very, very clear indicator of what's to come in the November release, which means, the Psionicist class, which is... That thing has been through so many revisions. It's crazy. But yeah, that class looks like a lot of fun, and they introduced a lot of just random archetypes and variant rules, and they revised the Ranger because the Ranger sucks. Just Unearthed Arcana is going away. Oh, and Sage Advice was a really good column, too, because, you know, sometimes there'd be these weird rules interactions, and they would take the time to explain them, and then, you know, every, like, 3 or 4 months, they would update the errata based off of things that were in Sage Advice. So it was a good thing for them to, like, have somebody on it actively looking at this stuff. So that Sage Advice is coming back as a monthly column on Wizards.com, and Unearthed Arcana is going back to a monthly column at Wizards.com starting in May. A lot of stuff happening
in May. Yeah, a lot of stuff happening in May. Well, now let's turn our attention to the Kickstarter news. And the first up is going to be in your wheelhouse, Robert. This is something you brought out, and that is Talislanta the Savage Land.
This is a really, really old RPG, and it was kind of made to be the anti-D&D. The thing that they always bill themselves as is, no elves here. Now the tagline is still no elves. Their whole thing was, this isn't a traditional fantasy world. This is something really bizarre and out there where there's no humans, there's no race that's like, you know, in ascendance. You know, there's a whole bunch of races that you've never heard of or seen. Or sadly, I've never read that game. I have one of the editions of it. It is a phone book. It is a massive, massive volume. There's a lot of lore. There's a lot of fluff. And it's just always been kind of this game that was sort of the anti-D&D. It was high fantasy, but it was like none of the trappings of D&D. They were very, very much against that. They were being contrary for contrariness' sake in a lot of cases when they were doing things with the setting. And thus, it's this really weird, cool setting. The Kickstarter's up now. They're going to have their classic system in it, which I've heard is very good. It's kind of a rules-light system from what I remember, because obviously D&D at the time was very crunchy, so being the anti-D&D, they were going to not do that. They're going to release it in the Open D6 from, like, the original Star Wars rule set back when West End Games owned it. That rule set. It's also going to be in 5th edition D&D, which, hey now, 5th edition D&D, I like that too. So this looks really cool. There's a lot of really weird, interesting art that you can see on the site.
Yeah, the art's fantastic. I like that stone golem that's on top of the mountain.
It's a great setting. There's a lot of just weird things in it that you can pull for your campaign.
Cool-looking werewolves, too.
I don't even think those are werewolves. I think those are just a race, if I remember correctly. It's been a long time. Like I said, I have one of these books, and I half read it 20 years ago, so I only sort of vaguely recall it. I was reading a lot about, you know, the history of Talislantia and reading some reviews of it I found around the internet. And it just, it's really cool that this is coming back, because the last edition came out. I heard that the last edition was 4th edition, and I was like, oh, I guess I have 3rd or something. And it's like, no, I had the 4th edition when I bought it 20 years ago. It's really cool that it's risen from the grave.
Yeah, I do like this new trend in role-playing games, seeing all these older games get a chance to come back and get updated for a modern edition. Yeah, I feel like without Kickstarter, though, I feel like a lot of these would have just been lost over time, and all we would have gotten is new systems. But the fact that we're seeing these older systems get this update, I really do believe it's just 100% because they can bring it to Kickstarter and appeal directly to that fan base.
Yeah, and you know, and if something doesn't quite click, you know, some old game doesn't quite work out or whatever, I mean, yeah, it doesn't get funded, and then whoever's got the license for that, you know, no harm, no foul, so it's kind of perfect for it in a weird way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not that I've ever seen that happen. I can't even think of one.
No, they usually fund pretty quick. That core fan base is pretty rabid for any given classic IP.
Yeah, so Talislantia, the Savage Land, it's Talislantia 5th edition if you're in the know. It just go check it out. If bizarre fantasy, just not anti-D&D, much more based off of Jack Vance and the Dying Earth, more so than, you know, Tolkien, sounds remotely interesting to you, go check it out. So, Jonathan, you brought this one to my attention, normally my eyes glaze over a little bit when you bring me a board game, because, you know, I just like minis.
But this is not a board game.
No. Anyway, Jonathan.
So this is...
Tell us about Star Eagles, Jonathan.
Yeah, this is Star Eagles, and this is interesting because it fits into a trend that I've been seeing in miniature gaming. It seems like there's a couple different trends happening in tabletop gaming in general right now. And one of them is this, there's a new trend towards a rule set in miniature gaming that lets you use any models that you have, basically giving you a set of rules to drop anything into. And that's essentially what Star Eagles is at its core. It's a space fighter combat rule system that lets you drop in any models that you want into it. You don't have to use their models. And that's really kind of what piqued my attention. Now, they do have models available in the Kickstarter.
And they've got fluff.
They are absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, they've got fluff and everything tied to them. If I had to say anything, it's kind of like, I almost want to say like, it's like Gradius ships. It kind of reminds me of like anime.
Yeah, I could see that.
Versus the Mimbari from Babylon 5. The curvy ships just kind of remind me of the Mimbari for reasons I can't fathom.
Now, it's interesting. The rule book does come with fluff for their particular world, but it also just has the core rules. And the core rules give you three different ways to play, which is why it's particularly interesting to me. The first way is very similar to X-Wing. 8 to 12 ships on a 4x4 space. So it's a little bigger than X-Wing. That's, you know, X-Wing is played traditionally on a 3x3. In the standard game mode, you get essentially what the X-Wing format is. You get dogfighting with templates that let you move around. Each one of the ships has its own stat card, which dictates which templates it can access, etc. Very, very similar to X-Wing.
Yeah,
and I don't
like
mean
it.
That in a bad way.
No.
Because you know what? That model really, really works well.
It's a fun game.
So in the standard format, ships are controlled and maneuvered individually, and individual pilot traits matter. Now, the second mode is 3 to 4 ships per player, and it's only played on a 3x3, so the X-Wing size. And this uses the standard engine, but it has more detailed ship damage, where the location of the damage actually matters and affects the handling and systems of your ship, which I thought was kind of interesting. Less ships and more focus on the damage.
Yeah, it reminds me of old-school games like Battletech and Crimson Skies and games that were a little bit more
crunchy,
fiddly. Yeah.
Finally, we get the last mode, and this is the one that piqued my attention the most, because I feel like this is something that X-Wing has not really done very well yet, and that is the Epic Battle Mode. And the Epic Battle Mode is designed to have 20 to 50 ships organized into squadrons of 3 to 6 each, and you play on a 4x6 table, and that's just going to be a form of Armageddon I can get behind. It's interesting because in this mode, the dogfighting is a bit more abstracted. Rather, you're focused on squadron-to-squadron combat, and it's interesting because they have an entire mechanic around the fog of war, not necessarily being able to see the entire battlefield at once. I'll be curious to see if they can pull that off, because how do you track it?
Games that go from sort of a micro scale to a macro scale, that's one of the things that's really hard to hit. That's Song of Ice and Fire, the minigames, trying to hit that too, which...
Yeah.
My only complaint is they have a lot of things where they say they're a two-player starter. I'm like, why don't you have two rule books? And that's my only complaint.
So it's launching with two factions. There are going to be stretch goals for a third faction. And it is a little bit complicated from a price perspective because there's a lot of different offerings, which kind of makes sense given what they're trying to pull off.
The one-player normal, the one-player deluxe, the two-player normal, the two-player deluxe. And there's a lot of just gradations between what you get. And then there's like, just get a pile of everything.
Yeah, so $10 gets you the PDF of the rule set. $30 gets you the printed rule set. $50 gets you a full digital package where you get core ships and these .stl files. This is the interesting part. The $50 full digital package comes with STL files for 3D printing. And I can't remember very many Kickstarters that have done something like that before. $60 gets you a two-player starter box set that gets you a few ships from the two different factions and templates and all the other good stuff. And then it just starts to go up from there, going all the way up to $600 where you get your very own custom space fighter. I'm curious about the rule set. I like the fact that you can just drop in any models. And I really like the fact that they are releasing the 3D files for people to print out on their own. Currently, it's not that old. It's got 24 days to go and is just shy of funding. They need $16,000 to fund and they just passed $14,000. So that is Star Eagles, a science fiction action game of futuristic space fighter combat.
Speaking of science fiction and this time going to RPGs, way, way back in the day, right before TSR folded, they started getting ready to produce a game called Alternity, which was their science fiction RPG. It was supposed to be the sci-fi D&D. That was kind of the idea. And it's one of those games, I have a lot of the books for it, and I never played it, which is a shame, because it looked kind of cool. It's sort of ahead of its time in a lot of ways in 1997, so obviously it's not ahead of its time anymore. But back
because
in the
we do live in the future.
We do live in the future. For the time, it had some interesting mechanics and interesting ideas. So what happened was, obviously, Wizards bought TSR. Wizards, I think, was the one that ended up actually producing what limited stuff they made for Alternity, and then Wizards got rid of it because they're like, we're going to just focus on D&D 3rd edition and not this other stuff. Because Wizards said that, they let Alternity go, and apparently the copyright for the term Alternity was not used long enough that it got passed back into the sort of public sphere, And so the original creators who now run Sasquatch Games, who you may recognize from the Elemental Evil storyline from D&D 5th Edition, they were like, ooh, Alternity. And so they snapped the trademark back up, and they're making another version of Alternity. Now, this will not be based on the original. This is going to be a new system because Wizards still owns that system, so yeah. That's a faux pas. But the basic idea, which is a generic system that you could run space opery sci-fi in, is what they're doing. And the interesting part is they have a free intro adventure, learn how to play. It doesn't have any real character generation stuff as pre-made characters, but you get a little adventure you can play, which is on DriveThruRPG right now for free, so you can test it out if you want it. Sci-fi just seems to be kind of hot right now.
Oh, yeah. You got Starfinder coming out. You've got this. You have Unity.
Starfinder.
Yeah.
The system looks cool. They have a lot of kind of fun art for it with vast alien vistas.
Yeah.
And
the art is really quite nice.
And the original creators of it are working on this new version. One of them's more in an advisory capacity. I think Bill Slavicek is kind of advising it. But Rich Baker and a whole bunch of sort of old guard from, you know, the second edition, third edition days of D&D are working on this as Sasquatch Studios. So, yeah, no, it looks really, really cool.
It's not that bad from a price perspective either. $25 gets you the PDF. $40 gets you the printed. For $45, you can get the entire PDF bundle, which is the core rulebook plus any supplements and adventures that are unlocked during the Kickstarter.
Yeah, they're trying to fund two books, and then there's a third that'll happen in stretch goals if they hit
it. $65 gets you the core rulebook plus the PDF bundle, and then it just goes up from there.
So that is Alternity, I guess 2017, new Alternity. I don't know what the nickname should be, but it's Alternity.
Alternity 2017 is how it's listed on Kickstarter, and it is doing pretty well. It's got 24 days to go, and it's just about to hit 25,000 in funding. They need 35,000 to fund, so I think it's safe to say that this one's going to be easily jumping over the finish line. All right, now that brings us up to our next game. Something that was on Kickstarter last year, and that is Centauri Saga, which is a really interesting co-op 4X game that was released on Kickstarter last year, and it did very, very well. It got funded, and now they are back with one of the most interesting expansions I've ever seen, which is why I put it on the show notes. Rather than just a standard expansion, more ships, more races, more whatever, what we are getting here is an expansion for a legacy mode. The legacy expansion is being billed as season one, meaning that they're obviously thinking more long-term from a story perspective. And it also comes with a version 1.5 revision of the rules for the original Centauri Saga. And, by the way, if you did not back the original Centauri Saga, this will give you the opportunity to purchase the original game as well. First of all, let's talk a little bit about Centauri Saga, since we've never talked about it on the show. It's a really neat-looking 4X game. Really nice miniatures. It's a completely co-op 4X game, which is unique. Most of the 4X games tend to be very head-to-head. There's an AI that is basically working against you, including bosses, which is kind of interesting. It's a lot of tokens, a lot of hex tiles, so you get a lot of variation every time you play it. And the version 1.5 upgrade gets you new rule books, updated cards with errata that's been applied, and a bunch of special events and new stuff that was not there previously, including the new Ravager miniature, which is kind of interesting. It's kind of like this organic space station. Now on to the new stuff, and that's the Legacy expansion. And I'm very curious to see how they take the original rule set and weave it into a Legacy game. That's really neat.
But still, yeah, adding a Legacy game into a 4X mode and getting to play things over and over, and especially since it's season one, I wonder if they're going to be clever and like season two will somehow pick up the story where you left off.
They're only looking for $15,000 to back this guy. They're already at $63,000. 19 days to go at the time of this recording. It's doing very, very well.
So by the time this comes out, you better jump on this. Like, it's made out of ham if you want it.
If you're a Centauri Saga owner, I think this is an easy purchase for you. It's worth it alone for the 1.5 upgrade. And the fact that you get the Legacy expansion as well is awesome. It's only $45. $90 will get you the core game and the upgrade pack and the season one expansion and all the stretch goals, which they've got some neat stuff planned out. And then it just goes up from there.
And that is Centauri Saga season one.
So now on to something that is on my shelf and that I've enjoyed playing and that you've enjoyed playing as well. So that is Sentinels of Earth Prime. And I find this interesting because this hooks into the Sentinels of the Multiverse universe, which came to a close last year.
Yeah, they did a final Kickstarter or something. So this is a new game. It's not set in the Sentinels of the Multiverse setting. Instead, what they're doing is they're teaming up with Green Ronin, who make the Mutants and Masterminds game, which is a really, really good RPG for superheroes,
yep,
which I've played a lot. And what it does is it uses the fluff from one of their established settings to sort of reboot, redo Sentinels of the Multiverse, but with new characters from Green Ronin's property and probably art from art assets from them as well. And that's really cool because now it's real comic books because now we've got an alternate universe or like a competing company's universe or something. So yeah, we're going to see the same game through a different lens. And there's a lot of really cool characters. And this is what I like about it, because I am way too deep into the Freedom City universe. So like being able to play some of these characters is going to be awesome. Because one of the cool things about Freedom City is it takes a lot of like the tropes from Marvel and DC Comics and sort of jams them together and files the numbers off and all that. But one of the big things that they always did with the setting was, for every year that really passed in our world, a year would pass in that world,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
and so every
cool.
time they update any of the setting books, they update it by the amount of years since the last one. So at this point, we've seen a lot of the characters that were in the air quotes, like X-Men, Teen Titans kind of group. A lot of them have grown up and now have like joined what the Justice League, for lack of a better term. They got their own names, of course, but yeah. And so there's like a new crowd in the Teen Titans. There's a lot of the older guys in the Justice League have now retired, and it's a really dynamic universe where, you know, you get to see characters kind of grow. And just as a story guy, because I play a lot of RPGs, that's neat. And then now being able to play these characters in Sentinels of the Multiverse, which is an awesome game. I can't wait. It has not hit Kickstarter as of this recording. Twitter said it should be out next week. So I don't know if that's Monday of next week or Friday of next week. Either way, it's probably out by the time you are hearing this. So yeah, go check it out. I will be looking at this Kickstarter, because yeah, Sentinels, I played it years ago because I didn't get a copy. I was playing a buddy's copy, but oh my god, that game was fun. I played the Batman-esque character and it was so much fun.
I love the idea. I love the universe. I'm really excited about this one. This looks awesome. So that is Sentinels of Earth Prime. We'll be back after a short break from our sponsors with our deep dive for the episode, and today we're going to be going into Arcadia Quest Inferno.
Captain, come in! It's a war zone out here! The trolls are about to overrun our position! There's casualties everywhere! No one can have a decent conversation without exploding into flame wars! I understand, sir. The other Mont and I are trying to hold them back, but no matter how many we ban, they just keep coming back in greater numbers! Captain, tell my wife. Free Buddha's Forums. A great place to chat with no trolls and no BS. All gaming, all the time. www.freebuddhas.com.
We love getting feedback, so please let us know how we're doing by doing one of the following.
You can email us at fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com.
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/forgotmydice. We post all our articles there, so feel free to comment, or you can message us directly via the Facebook Messenger.
We also have Facebook comments enabled for all our posts at forgotmydice.com.
You can also message us or tweet us on the Twitter. Find us at ForgotMyDice.
You can join us on the Freebooter Network message boards. Find your way there by going to freebootersnetwork.com and click on the Freebooters Forum.
If you like the show, the best way for more people to find out about us is to give the Freebooters Network a review on iTunes.
Lastly, for those of you listening from the depths of interstellar space, make sure you turn your controls 18 degrees to the left and flip the intensifier disc on and off again.
Interstellar space?
Yeah, they listen to podcasts on interosters.
And now it's time for our deep dive for the episode. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about Arcadia Quest Inferno. New from CMON, cool mini or not. And it's the third game in the Arcadia Quest world.
Arcadia Quest Inferno is both a standalone game and an expansion to the smash hit Arcadia Quest. In this 2-4 player board game, players lead guilds of intrepid heroes down into Inferno on an epic campaign to thwart the evil underlord's evil schemes and save the city of Arcadia. But only one guild will be victorious, so players must battle against each other as well as the demonic forces. Going down into the infernal depths presents the heroes of Arcadia with a new set of challenges and opportunities in the form of damnation. This dark power permeates everything in Inferno, and daring heroes may want to use it to their advantage and face the consequences.
So yeah, let's talk about Arcadian Quest Inferno. It takes the basic Arcadia Quest model, which is 2 to 4 players. Each player controls a guild of 3 different characters, and you basically only take 2 actions in any given turn. You move, and you attack. And you can do those in either order. You can attack, then move, or move, then attack.
These aren't characters, sir. They are straight-up murder hobos.
Yeah, they really are.
This is Murder Hobo the game, straight up. And we'll get to that. But there's a lot of ways that you're murder hobos in this game.
Now, the whole core of the game is that you're running around this little dungeon, and you're trying to do what amount to quests. And these quests can be either player versus environment, like get all of your characters into a certain zone.
Or kill Cerberus.
Or kill a certain enemy. Or they can be player versus player, kill another player from another guild, etc. They're kind of interesting that way because they change up with every single scenario. And this game is, in fact, scenario-based, and it is actually campaign-based, which is neat. You can play any of the scenarios as a standalone, and you can select the level to play it at, which basically alters difficulty level, because all of the enemies in the game have a variety of different cards with them that let you scale them up to whatever level you want to play as. And that's important because you're going to have a lot of equipment that makes you considerably more powerful. So
Wait. You have a golf bag full of equipment on your characters?
Well, not quite a golf bag. You get 4 equipment slots per character that you can fill with all the different treasures that you purchase after a round or find in the environment.
Murder hobos!
So the basic mechanics are this. You get 3 movement points in a turn. So you can use those movement points to open doors, use those movement points to move from square to square, or you can use them to search whatever square you happen to be on if there's a searchable item on that square.
Which is nice, because you don't have to search every square at random. You know where things are. Everything's laid out well beforehand.
That's yes, part of the game, yes, so. Exactly. And in fact, that is part of the setup, is you look at the scenario in the scenario book, and you set it up just like they have it mapped out. Everything is also reasonably asymmetrical as well. And that is by design, to make sure that every guild has the same level of challenge moving around and the same level of challenge right outside of their spawn, essentially.
My favorite bit is you roll dice to attack and defend, which we'll get into. But the other players roll the monsters,
yes.
Which is fun, because it starts setting up that player versus player mentality where I am not the succubus that is attacking you, but I am rolling for her, and I get to share in that victory if I score a lot of hits, which is a lot of fun.
It should be said that the Arcadia Quest series is all about ribbing each other at the table, taking pot shots at each other, trying to make each other's life a little more difficult. The rolling for the enemy creatures is definitely captured that way, because the player to your right is who rolls any enemy creatures that are trying to attack you. And let's talk about attack, because that takes us into the combat discussion. All of your characters have a base set of stats. Those stats do not include an attack level. Your base stats will have a defense rating, which lets you know how many dice you throw when you're defending. Your stats will have a base health level, and they'll also have a special power. And that special power is completely unique for every single character in the Arcadia Quest universe, of which there must be about 60 or 70.
Now. Yeah, there's a lot spread out over all the games.
Between the 2 games, the expansions, and just the character packs, yeah, there's quite a few out there.
And it was interesting, because I, of course, played a trio of paladins, because you always play the paladin. Hashtag, always play the paladin. One of my paladins had an ability where they got to roll extra defense dice if I expended their card like an item. And then one of my paladins just had a flavor text, and I was like, what's their ability? And I was really confused until you pointed out that her stats, this is D.Va, the same character I played last time, actually, Masmora. D.Va's defensive stats are real, real high. All of her stats are real, real high compared to everything
She's
else.
She's the only character I've ever seen that rolls 4 defense die. Most roll 1, maybe 2.
Yeah, exactly. So she's really beefy. Most people's, the together of your health and your defense die, typically equals 6, although one of your characters had 5. D.Va's equaled 8. She had 4 and 4. So she was a real beefy character. She was very tanky.
So that was her special power. Yeah, it makes sense she wouldn't have a special power beyond that.
It's interesting from a balance perspective, because everybody's got one of these abilities, and none of them stuck out as being overly powered.
Like, well, D.Va's, I played a fair amount of Arcadia Quest with characters from both the first game, the second game, and now some Masmora characters, and I can tell you, they're never wildly unbalanced. They're never wildly out of control. Everything just kind of balances out no matter what trio of characters you choose.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I didn't play what you'd call a balanced party. I just picked 3 paladins because that was my gimmick I was going with for this game. And it worked. And then I don't know what gimmick you were going for. I think you were just going with rule of cool.
Yeah, I just chose three characters that just kind of tickled my fancy at the time. I think the next time we play, my plan is to just take anthropomorphic characters.
Nice. So the way you attack is your gear is actually, your murder hobo bag is tied to your attacks. And so to attack, like, I had a dusty sword on D.Va. And so if I want to attack something with a dusty sword, you have to exhaust the item. And so when I attack with the sword, I flip the sword over. And that means I can't use it again until I rest. And so once your gang of murder hobos has gone through all of their gear, or whenever you feel like it, you have to take an action where you just don't do anything and you rest and you flip everything back.
Yeah, you don't move, you don't attack, you just rest. And that lets you reset all of your exhausted cards. Now, it is important to note that the reason why the exhaustion of the cards is important is because those cards tell you what your attack value is. Using your Dusty Sword as an example, that has an attack rating of 3. Mm-hmm. So that means that you use 3 of the attack dice, and that's what you're rolling with. And it's a melee weapon, which means that you are looking for melee symbols on the dice. So the attack dice have 3 symbols on it. Melee, which is a little sword. Ranged, which is a little bow and arrow. And then finally, the crit symbol, which is like a little explosion. And the crit symbol is important because when you get it, it's a wild. It can act as either a melee or a ranged. And you get to grab another dice and chuck it. And if you get another crit, you get to grab another dice and chuck it. And sometimes you'll get these awesome, awesome strings of 3 or 4 dice chucks. I think the most I had last night was, what, 3?
3, yeah. Yeah. And the symbols are distributed evenly. It's 2 swords, 2 bows, and 2 crits, if I'm not mistaken. And then the defense dice have 2 shields on them, which is just defending against attacks, and then a crit, which functions the same way as a melee.
And, unfortunately, a couple blank sides.
Yeah, 3.
That you take the hit without defending.
Yeah, yeah. So say I'm being attacked by a monster, and the monster, or you, because you're rolling for the monster, jerk, you roll 3 swords. I then have to pick up however many defense dice I get, and I have to roll 3 crits or shields or whatever to just try to defend against it. And anything in excess, like if you roll 3 hits and I roll 2 defense, I just take a point of damage, and that's it, the difference.
Now, when you attack a monster, it's kind of interesting because they have 2 ratings for getting attacked. They have their health, and then they have a secondary rating that's generally a couple numbers higher, and that is their overkill rating. The reason an overkill is important is because if you do not overkill a monster, they get an automatic payback attack on you, which is the primary method that the monsters use to attack you. Because they tend to be a little more passive in this game. They're not actively seeking you out, but they will defend themselves.
Exactly. And so, like, one of the succubuses, she had 2 health, and then it was 4 overkill. And so if you're lucky enough to hit her for 4 points of damage, she just didn't get to hit you back. Otherwise, you got to roll those defense dice. And it's an elegant solution to the problem of how do you have the monsters do AI, which I liked about this one. The monsters don't. They just sit there. Until you go and mess with them.
Yes, exactly. And they can be messed with by players as well, because certain game cards will, in fact, give you permission to grab a monster and move them around and have them attack other players.
Yeah.
It's some of the gentle elbowing that occurs between players. And that's really kind of the core of this game. This game is all about messing with each other, and that's what I love about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of fun. Every time you kill a monster, or for the most part, every time you kill a quest, every time you do a quest, you get gold. Typically it's 1, but the Cerberus gave us 2. It's what you want if you're playing in the campaign mode, because the more gold you have as you go along, the more murder hobo stuff you can shove in your golf bag as you level up.
So let's talk about that campaign for a moment, because it's one of the core ways that Arcadia Quest Inferno and the original Arcadia Quest are played. You do have this very long campaign, and what's great about it is that there are several paths that you can take through the levels of the campaign. And in Inferno, you start out on the first level of hell, and then when you move into the second level of hell, at the beginning of the second level, you get to choose from one of 2 different sides of the map. You have the east side and the west side. And each of those sides has 3 different levels. You can attack them in any order. And as soon as you've completed 2 of those levels, you get to move to the next level of hell. And that is how you can continuously advance. In any given campaign, there's going to be a total of 4 scenarios that you do not see on any given level of the game. And that's great, because that gives you tons of replayability. Once you get to the end of the campaign, you can just turn around and go right back through it, and you're going to get a completely different experience. Now, each of the scenarios gives you a map. It tells you which tiles to lay out, which scenery components to put down, and most importantly, which monsters to put down. And then you just go through the scenario. And those scenario goals, which amount to the quests that the players are trying to complete, are also how you trigger a win condition. Because the first player to get 3 of those triggers the win condition immediately, and play comes to a stop, and you move into the upgrade phase in between levels of the campaign.
So there's a deck of cards that you get. There's up to 5 different levels of them. Basically, the items just get better the more you level up. And the gold you've earned during the game is how you purchase these cards, which you then give to your characters. And they can have up to 4 items. If you get more than 4 items, you have to start discarding. But then again, by the time you're at that point, you probably need to get rid of your level 1 items and replace them with your level 2, because you got to make that golf bag more pretty.
Yep. You
got to get the sword plus 2 in there somewhere. It's a very simplified mechanic. I've seen a lot of these adventure games, and just the way that they handle progression is just these items that you get. Your characters don't actually change. And
it's straightforward. It's to the point without obfuscating it with a lot of extra fluff.
Yeah, yeah. And don't get me wrong, like the crunchier games, they definitely have their place, but this one, I like
that. It's not what it's about, right?
Right, yeah. This one's much more streamlined, and that's kind of its focus. And it shows in pretty much all levels of the game.
Yeah. It wants you to get through the upgrade phase as quick as possible so that it can get back to.
So you can re-rack and start playing again, yeah.
So now, during the course of the campaign, you're going to encounter death.
Yes.
And that's a normal part of Arcadia Quest. In fact, I would say that the expectation is that you are going to die a lot. And in Inferno, there's a couple of new mechanics that were not previously in Arcadia Quest associated with that.
When your character dies, they're just immediately everything's exhausted, and they go back to your little tableau. And then once you take the rest action, your character comes back. If your character dies, they get a death token. For every death token you get at the end of the game, you get a curse. And a lot of those curses, in fact, we dealt out like 7 of them in our game. All of them said nothing happened.
Yeah, we got really lucky in that shuffle.
But yeah, basically your death curse just lasts for the next game.
The next scenario.
It's annoying, yes, but it's not permanent on that character.
And nor is it going to be game-changing.
Yeah, yeah. And that's it. I mean, you know, whenever you take the rest action to refresh your characters, you get to have your guy back. Monster deaths, on the other hand, are handled sort of a similar way. Basically, you have a track of 5 monsters, and once you fill up the track and get your 5th monster, and basically every time you kill another monster, it just knocks everybody down the queue. And so once you knock someone off the queue, then you get to roll.
Each map has several spawn points on it that are dictated by the campaign, and you choose these randomly. You have a bunch of different tiles that you flip over and just choose the first couple that come up for any given scenario. And those all have a combination of symbols, and what you do is you roll 2 dice, and based on those symbols, you respawn whoever's next in the queue.
And if those 2 symbols don't come up, like say arrow isn't there, that monster just vanishes in the void. It doesn't come
back. They're out of the game.
It's a really interesting mechanic to have the monsters come back after you kill them. And these are for just the general monsters. The more tough monsters like the Cerberuses that we mentioned in the scenario we played, they don't get to come back like that. That's not their place. The nameless goons are the ones that get to respawn, like in a video game.
And that's the basics of Arcadia Quest.
Yeah, yeah.
With one exception, that in Inferno, the whole concept is that you're going into the Arcadia Quest version of Hell. Part of that is that you are tempted constantly with the concept of damnation. You can get 1 extra attack if you take a little damnation.
If you have a cursed item or a damnation item. So yeah. Some of the items in Inferno have basically, you can use damnation as a resource with this magic spell that's a little bit evil. If you damage somebody with it, you can take a point of damnation to hit them with 2 point or an extra point of damage instead of whatever you hit. And it's like, oh, you know, if I do that, it's a finisher. I could kill that monster. I killed one of your players that because you had 2 hit points left. And I'm like, I'll do that to kill one of your players. Why not? Or you can spend a point of damnation and roll an extra die. For every 2 points of damnation you have at the end of the game, you get one of these death curses.
Yes.
And they carry over, because there are ways to get rid of damnation as the game progresses, but they are few and far between.
Yes, and during gameplay, a lot of the cards will reference the player with the most damnation, or the player on the other team with any damnation. And some weapons actually will interact with the damnation of your target. And that's important because, generally speaking, the more damnation you have, the more of a soft target you are, and it's not going to work in your favor. So it really does become this great risk versus reward component to the gameplay. Yes, you can have your extra hit, but how will it bite you in the rear later?
It's just fun. It's another resource to play with, which added a little bit more
depth
to the game than I think it probably needed. Over long-term play, I could see how it would pop up. One of the spells I had was if I hit, I could take damnation off my character, which I was like, yeah, I need that. Because at the end, I realized I was a little behind in the gold, and so I started using more damnation to try to catch up.
Let's talk about the core gameplay here, Robert. What did you think of it?
Overall, it was a nice little straightforward game. Like, I played a little bit of first edition Descent. I hear second edition is much more streamlined when compared to it. I played Undercity. So I played a few of these sort of adventure games. And this one, of all of the ones I played, was probably the most streamlined and the most simple. Like, it wasn't fiddly, you know? There wasn't a lot of... Yeah, there weren't any fiddly bits. And that was nice, because it was one of those things where I didn't have to worry about the rules getting in the way of me figuring out the game. Because the first time I played Undercity, oh my god.
There's a lot of crunch in the Undercity.
Yeah. We played literally for 3 hours, and that was like our first couple of turns. And then we played just as many turns in the final 45 minutes once everything clicked together.
Yeah.
And yeah, this game just boom, 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 boom. It just went. Like, I got it pretty much out of the gate. And that's because it's simple. It's straightforward.
And that's half the fun, because it goes so quickly. It's so much fun to play because it's fast.
Right. But if you want a game with depth, this isn't a terribly deep game. This is a streamlined, straightforward game. And yes. So,
and it's not necessarily a knock to it.
The
design choice that was made.
If your tastes go the other way, that is something to keep in mind for this game. So Jonathan, as is FMD tradition, I did not read the rules beforehand because I am lazy. So, how's that rule book?
The rule book in this is relatively straightforward.
No, wait. A Simon book with a straightforward rule book?
I did say relatively.
Okay.
The rule book does a really good job of walking you through initial setup. Where it suffers is in calling out some of the idiosyncrasies of the game that really should be called out earlier, because they helped us give you a little context for the basics of the game. But that being said, for a cool mini or not rule book, this one is actually probably one of the best. It's a very straightforward game, and it gets very straightforward rules. It handles them relatively well. I would have maybe done a little bit of reorganization, but it's a minor complaint. And in the back of the rulebook, there's an index, which is something that you rarely see in a CMON game. So that was really, really nice to see. Plus, you get some really fun fluff at the beginning, too, that sets up the world. Robert, what did you think about the components of the game?
I don't know what we could say here that we didn't say last time with Masmora, because it's the same universe and it used all of the same models, except for the monsters, I guess. The monsters are more what you get. It's the chibi art style. Inferno is all about, you know, it's hell, so there's a lot of demons. We had a lot of succubuses and then Cerberus. Oh, and we had harpies. We had winged women. Yeah, I don't know what I could say this time that I didn't say last time. The models are chibi. They're cute. They're very high quality. There's a very definite difference between D.Va, which was from the original Arcadia quest, and then the dragon. I can't remember the dragon, like Torgor or whatever his name was. But
just in the dynamic nature of the poses.
Yeah. The more recent models are definitely better. But, you know, the first edition models are fine. They're just not anything. And that's
really good detail on the models.
Yeah. And that's the part I liked, getting back to the characters. I was playing with characters from the entire... I was playing with a conversion character from Masmora, who was originally from Masmora, and then they gave you cards to play him in Arcadia Quest.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing with an Inferno character, and I was playing with D.Va from the original Arcadia Quest. And it was fun.
Everything hooks together great, and you had a very viable team.
Yeah. And that's also what I liked about this game. Like I said, I had the trio of paladins, and it wasn't like I had to make a balanced party like you ordinarily would want to, maybe in an RPG, where I should have like the tank, the healer, and the ranged or whatever. It's just, you know, pick three characters that you like, you know? If you like Bard Elvis and Dinosaur Headed Druid Lady and the Panda Guy, like, do it. It doesn't matter. You know, it's just about having fun.
And that really, I'm glad that you said that, because that really is the focus at all times in this game. Nothing gets in the way of having fun. Everything is always nice and streamlined and quick, because it wants you to get back to the fun. It wants you to get back to all that awesome dice chucking, which can be really exciting, especially in higher player games.
Yeah. The map tiles were colorful, they're bright.
Gorgeous. It's great art.
They're not warping. I mean, it was the same thing with Masmora. Like I said, I don't know what to say about this game that I didn't say about Masmora. It's all the same components, and they're all very, very good.
So let's talk about recommended player count for a moment. Now, unfortunately, you only had the opportunity to play it in the two-player configuration, which is the smallest way that Arcadia Quest works. But that being said, it still does work, and works well.
Yeah, we had a good time. And I could see with more players, there would be a lot more...
pandemonium.
Yeah, there'd be a lot more interaction between the players.
And that's really where Arcadia Quest is best. It really is truly best at its four-player mode, because the more interaction you have between the guilds, the more exciting and frantic it gets. And the harder it is to finally achieve those in-game quests that let you get the win condition for any given scenario. So yeah, I would say that the recommended player count is definitely going to be as high as possible. Get it up to those four players and play through a campaign. It's awesome. Of course, at the end of every review, we ask the eternal question. And this is really, you know, how we pass judgment on the game, yay or nay. And that is it fun to play?
Arcadia Quest is a lot of fun to play. And it's interesting, because I got to play Masmora first, which is arguably its less complex spin-off game. And then I got to play, you know, sort of the Papa version of it. It's an interesting point and counterpoint where Masmora, you know, it's the very rules light. It's the very, you know, kind of play it for an evening game, you know, get your feet wet game. This game does work better the more you play it as a campaign. Because I tilted a little bit because you literally at the end of the game got double the gold that I got.
But I ended up not mattering.
Right, right. But that's the point. Like, I got 11, you got 22. I ended up spending 7 of my 11 gold on the upgrades I wanted to purchase for the next game, and my allergies were killing me, so I couldn't bring myself to do one. And then you, I don't know how much gold you spent.
I ended up spending 11.
11.
So half of my gold got thrown away.
Yeah, and then you don't keep your gold between, you keep one gold between games if you have any left over. So if somebody manages to luck their way into pulling ahead, and a lot of that was just, you know, there's sort of like random finds.
I really had right place, right time.
Right, yeah.
A lot in that.
Yeah, game. But it's definitely a little bit more crunchy. It's definitely got a little bit more complexity. It definitely needs to be played over time. But I don't think it was much more complex than Masmora.
No, not at all. And in fact, we've already talked about just how streamlined this rule set is.
Yeah, so it's, I don't know, I like it. I dig it. It's one of the many reasons that I want to play a campaign game.
Yeah.
And deep dive that, because we've got so many of them, and so many of them are fun, but we only get to review them once.
I've always liked Arcadia Quest a lot, and Inferno adds that extra little layer to it that makes it that much more fun with the damnation mechanic. I think that the Arcadia Quest games are phenomenal for all the reasons that you just stated. They're quick, they've got a great campaign mode, they've got great progression without ever having too much crunch, and it all comes together in this great little package with fantastic immersion from the art and the little chibi minis.
I want to play campaign so bad, and I want to play with pets.
Yes. So one of the things that we have not tried out yet, and we'll have to talk about it in a future show, is the pets expansion, which is a new concept that also is available in retail that takes the basic Arcadia Quest mechanics and gives each guild a little pet that can do some additional actions, which really would change the nature of gameplay.
And the pets are super cute.
Yeah, they really are.
Oh my god, they're so cute. And the best part of the pets expansion, there's hulking monsters, koala bear enemies, which is amazing.
That is the basics of Arcadia Quest Inferno. Is it fun? Yes, absolutely. It's a fantastic game with a really high production quality, and there's a lot of replayability in that box. Plus, you can take all of the stuff from Inferno, take it into the original Arcadia Quest, vice versa. Also include Masmora. You get a lot of really great play between these three properties that take place in that universe.
And I love how the Masmora stuff, you didn't have to buy a conversion kit. The conversion kit you got was to take everything from Arcadia Quest and put it in Masmora.
But everything from Masmora, you definitely get the sense that that's because Masmora didn't exist.
Right, exactly. But, you know, this game, it's perfect. Like, all the Masmora stuff has cards for Arcadia Quest. Yeah. And
so that is Arcadia Quest Inferno. It retails for $99.99. And it is, of course, from CMON. Cool Mini or not, it is now out in stores. It is a great little game. So that brings us to the end of another episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast. As we round out this episode 16, Robert, do you have any final thoughts for the audience?
Yeah, just remember, everybody, Patreon, Riffs Books, contest, episode 20. I guess go back to the front of the episode if you want that in context, because I'm not giving it to you now.
Absolutely, we appreciate any help that we can get, and we're going to continue to bring you awesome, awesome gaming content from all corners of the gaming world. So as we round out another awesome episode, we will see you in 2 weeks with episode 17 of the Forgot My Dice podcast. Lots of good stuff in line for that one. And, of course, check out our show notes available at ForgotMyDice.com and join all of our digital fun with the Facebook page, the Twitter feed, and, of course, go take a look at the Freebooters Network and join us on our forums.
I've been adding art to our Pinterest page, too, because I started to look at that again.
And there you go. Well, Robert,
I found a great board of creepy castles that I've been adding to the Dracula dossier folder, because there is a lot of art of creepy castles. It is surprising.
Well, as we round out this episode, Robert, party on.
Party on, Jonathan.
The music you heard in this podcast was Intro by Elefiel and Retro Funk by Persephone, both used with permission via the Creative Commons license.